This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Hello there, Buzzkillers. Well, as you know, this is the best history podcast in the entire podcast universe. And the reason for that is because we are fortunate enough to have the best historians come on the show. And it's your treat today because Professor Linda Colley, who is the Shelby M.C. Davis 1958 Professor of History at Princeton University, and someone I've admired for many years now, is on the show here to talk about her new book, The Gun, the Ship, and the Pen: Warfare, Constitutions, and the Making of the Modern World. Welcome to the show, Professor Colley.
Great pleasure to be here.
You're very much known in my field, certainly, and in modern British history and world history as an ideas historian. You take on big concepts, national identity and things like that. And this is among the biggest concepts there can be. What was the nature of constitutions and why they developed so explosively during the modern period? I was interested to read, for instance, that, you know, there's sort of different reactions to your book. Half the people who review it seem to be talking about the technological things, the printing press and things like that. But then the other half of the people who review it refer to the correlation between warfare and then the development of constitutions afterwards. It seems to me the latter is a much stronger or much more prevalent part of the book. But of course, these things go together. How did you hit upon that idea as that realization that there is this such a strong correlation between warfare and constitution writing?
As you know, I mean, that constitutions, lists of laws, go back to ancient times in many societies.
Right.
But what I wanted to focus on was what was clearly a rising curve upwards of a rather different constitution from the middle of the 18th century, a single document constitution that was written down, put into print, widely distributed. And I wanted to explore why that happened when it did, and increasingly happened. Mm-hmm. And it was perfectly clear to me as I researched more into, well, what is one of the main things that's happening in the mid-18th century? Well, clearly you've got this extraordinary war, the war that the British style, the Seven Years' War, though obviously only retrospectively, and Americans call the French and Indian War, and which goes into so many continents and is so expensive in money as well as in men. And that is driving the production of new kinds of iconic texts, not just in places that have revolutions, classically the new United States, but also in places that you wouldn't anticipate, like Russia, which I talk about in my second chapter. Mm-hmm. But it always slightly amuses me when critics say, oh, you said it was war, but you're talking about print now, or you're talking about the Enlightenment. Well, it's not a case of either or.
Right, right.
I think war is the main recurrent driver, but it wouldn't have been so powerful without an explosion of print and literacy, and of course, all sorts of Enlightenment ideas in parts of the world.
Yes, you show not only just in the American context, but in other contexts, how quickly constitutions after they're written, and even things like declarations of independence, are printed and distributed. The American Constitution gets distributed almost immediately by 18th century standards. But I'm also interested that there's a wonderful sentence in your introduction where you talk about this part of warfare, where you say that a major outbreak of warfare generally gives those ordinary men and women who are caught up in it a rawer appreciation of the contours, ruthlessness, and deficiencies of the prevailing systems of authority. That seems to me quite a linchpin to the setting up the arguments that you're making.
Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of top-down and a bottom-up element of this. At one level, states are either being overthrown and new states emerge which want to legitimize themselves, and constitutions can do that. But even states that survive, the rulers may say, look, in order to fight these wars, we've got to raise more taxes. Therefore, we basically need a contract.
Mm-hmm.
We will issue a constitution or some kind of new written text which promises males, and of course it is almost exclusively males at this stage, extra assets, if you like, in return for their military service or greater taxes. So that's the top-down response to more wars. But as you suggest, wars also can incite opposition and fresh claims from below, because wars disrupt trade, they disrupt lives, they're expensive, they take people's sons or husbands. And as Tom Paine, mm-hmm. Was very clear in his wonderful polemics, wars can rip the veil away from state power and allow people to see it in much harsher terms. And that too could increase the demand for a new basis for government.
But is there something about this period specifically, because you can argue that there's the warfare aspect, the top-down aspect, the bottom-up aspect, and the modern technology? Is this why you don't, for instance, give a complete world history of constitutions back to Hammurabi and ancient texts? Is there something about 1750-ish that makes things so much more different than previous periods?
Oh, I think so. Because, you know, the early codes of law, which are engraved on stone mm-hmm. or on parchment, these are purely elite documents. They are often not mass produced. And anyway, in the ancient past, of course, very few people could read.
Right.
So in order to get single document written constitutions really to have traction, you need various things. You need a working network of print. You need more people to be able to read. You need transport systems to carry print into different parts of your state. So it is partly that this is a changed kind of political technology, responding substantially to different kinds of wars, much bigger wars, more expensive wars than before,
mm-hmm.
And taking advantage of other cultural and technological shifts that are happening in some parts of the world, not, of course, in all parts of the world.
Yes, but what another thing that's so interesting is you talk about how there are some, you know, innovative constitutions that emerge outside of Europe and North America. For instance, you talk about Pitcairn Island, which was fascinatingly illuminating to me, and that would not necessarily, one would think, have a tremendous printing press explosion like, you know, Boston would have, or London would have, or St. Petersburg would have.
To put it mildly, no. I wanted to include the Pitcairn episode because it is so fantastic. Pitcairn is the place, of course, where the surviving mutineers from HMS Bounty finally end up with their Tahitian friends and lovers. Very few of them survive on Pitcairn, which is this tiny rocklet in the South Pacific. And by the 1830s, there's anyway only about 100 of them, mainly non-white. And they feel threatened by the fact that American whalers from the East Coast are landing on their rock, threatening to take it over. And then a Scottish naval captain arrives who, of course, gives them a Union Jack, but also drafts what becomes a constitution. And this draft document is the first document I know of in global history which gives women the vote on the absolutely the same terms as men. And this constitution survives until the 1920s or 30s. But of course, you only at that stage had 100 people on Pitcairn. So you didn't need printing machinery to spread the news in that kind of tiny population. But what you find happening in other parts of the Pacific, like Tahiti, like Hawaii emphatically, is that with missionaries establishing themselves, they bring in print to spread the Bible and the Christian world. This allows in Hawaii, the monarchy in Hawaii, to set up a Hawaiian constitution and Declaration of Rights in the late 1830s, and to spread it, because courtesy of the missionaries and of missionary schools, they've now got a written language, they've got printing networks, and they can factor in this constitutional technology for their own indigenous purposes. This is not just genuflecting to the West, it's adapting a device and putting it to rather different purposes.
Do we know the extent to which the Pitcairn one, the Tahitian one, the Hawaiian one, had an influence in other Pacific island nations?
Well, what happened on Tahiti was certainly learnt about by, for example, radicals in Australia, who said, well, you know, they've got a document. Why haven't we got a document? This is in the 1830s. And the Hawaiian constitution, which the Hawaiian rulers have disseminated in different Western capitals, partly to argue against their being colonized. They say, look, we have a constitution now. It's a printed constitution. We are modern.
Right.
We are up there. We are not fit material for colonization. And one of the capitals they send this document to is Paris, Paris, France, as it's often put. We know that in the 1850s, some Tunisian leading military men and constitutionalists visit Paris. And I wonder whether they didn't see this Hawaiian text, which had been translated into French. And this helped to nurture the idea behind what becomes the Tunisian constitution of 1861, the first Muslim modern constitution, because the aim is to say Tunisia is a modern state now. It has a constitution, hands off the West.
Right. Which is presumably directed especially at the imperializing powers.
Yes. I have to say these strategies, of course, don't work. Hawaii gets annexed by the United States. Tunisia gets taken by the French. But Hawaii gets at least, and I think this is very much with the help of these constitutions, a kind of 50-year breathing space before Washington takes over.
Well, if we could go for a second to the sort of other, the top end of the political spectrum or the most powerful end of the political spectrum. It is surprising to learn that, you know, some early experiments and constitutions were made by people like Catherine the Great, as much as by people like Thomas Paine and other revolutionaries. I think a lot of our listeners might think that monarchs and absolutist monarchs might lose in by writing constitutions or agreeing to constitutions or exploring the idea of constitutions, that their power will leak away if they agree to that. But this is, as you show in so many instances in the book, it's much more complicated and interesting than that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important to remember that outside the Americas, most states in most continents are monarchies as late as the First World War.
Right.
So if constitutions had been confined to republics, they'd have stayed confined for a very long time. But Catherine the Great does not issue a constitution in what becomes the American sense, but she does in the 1760s issue a very innovating document called the NACAS, which is an attempt to systematize and bring together a Russian law code. And she sets up in Moscow what is a kind of convention to discuss this NACAS, which she has drafted substantially herself. Mm. And the NACAS brings representatives from all the Russian Empire, including Muslim representatives, including representatives for which some female landowners have voted by proxy. So in many ways, it's a very ambitious convention, which then discusses this extraordinary document. Now, nothing really comes of it in Russia for various reasons, but it's translated the NACAS into dozens and more than dozens of languages. And I think it publicizes this notion that now is the time for iconic political and legal texts that can bring together peoples in rather different ways. And the fact that someone who is an authoritarian and ruthless empress, as Catherine is, albeit a very clever woman, can see the point of this kind of text, shows that constitutions and quasi-constitutions can appeal to those in charge, not just to those at the bottom. They can systematize and enable power, as well as, in some cases, conceding rights and putting brakes on power. And I wanted to get these different sides of what these kind of texts do. I wanted to set them out, if I could.
May we move on to the British? I'd like to finish off the show with the British case and the American case, because those are most of our listeners are in the United States and in Britain. And you make very interesting arguments about, for instance, how Magna Carta is often referred to as an early constitution, that there are other early attempts at constitutionizing, maybe the Glorious Settlement, the English Bill of Rights, things like that. Could you explain to our listeners the frankly, very complicated nature of what is English/British constitutionalism?
Right. Well, Britain, what is now the UK, certainly doesn't lack constitutional documents.
Right.
It has arguably far too many, not just statute law, important rulings at different times, but really iconic documents like, of course, the Magna Carta, like the Bill of Rights of 1689, which, of course, is a title that gets taken up by Americans later. But these myriad documents are not systematized or codified in one single or would-be single text. They're dispersed. Mm-hmm. And there's a growing feeling in Britain now that this is simply not a safe or valid system, but that's another matter. So what you see is the British in one way being very precocious with their constitutional writing, and certainly they are extremely precocious during the English civil wars of the 1640s, 1650s, where you do get attempts at something like manhood suffrage, something that's approaching a codified constitution, the 1653 instrument of government. Mm-hmm. But in the end, the Republic is closed down in 1660, the monarchy comes back, and this mid-17th century experiment gets suppressed. And all you've got is this vast array of constitutional documents. So you've got a strong sense of writtenness mm-hmm. in British culture, but not a single constitutional text of the sort that, of course, Americans value so much.
But I remember just in general sort of conversations and shooting the breeze with my friends when I was studying British history. You know, we talked about, well, we wondered aloud whether that sort of, you know, the British Constitution is the broadest possible document/documents in the world. But that there might be a benefit to that. It allows for certain flexibilities, the various reform acts in the 19th century and all the way up to what is now called the Fourth Reform Act, the women's enfranchisement, partial enfranchisement, those sorts of changes might have been too hemmed in if the country had been sort of anchored to a single document constitution.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the rationalizations. Mm-hmm. Indeed, by the end of the 19th century, British apologists for the British system are referring to codified constitutions as rigid
right.
constitutions, that they're just very difficult to change. And of course, to a degree, that is valid. I mean, the US Constitution, the federal constitution was designed so that it would not be easy to amend mm-hmm. because the founding fathers thought that this would aid stability, which they desperately wanted in 1787. But, you know, there are disadvantages to that. There's also very ancient ideas behind this. There's a debate in classical times, there's a debate in the Bible about, do you really want to write down your laws, or should they be internalized?
All right.
St. Paul says in the New Testament that the best laws are not inscribed in stone, they are in the heart.
Right.
And for some, again, British apologists, this makes sense. They argue, well, you know, we know our constitutional system. It is in the heart. We don't want to codify it. The problem comes, of course, when the constitutional system, as now in the UK, is so old and so complicated that it isn't in the heart anymore, and more people need to be informed about what that system actually is.
Do you foresee a time when there might be a British or post-independent Scotland, an English constitution in a single document?
I think it's possible. The Scottish National Party has said that if Scotland does secede, that they want a codified constitution. It is possible that Northern Ireland post-Brexit will reunite with the Irish Republic, in which case you'll have to have a new Irish constitution.
Right.
That would leave England and Wales on their own. It would cause such a shock that the pressure to write down a new system in those two remaining countries, England and Wales, would be unstoppable.
Right.
But of course, this is in the future, and I'm just a historian.
Well, let's end up with your discussion of the American Constitution, because one of the things that struck me so vividly when you talked about it was what you call this cult of the Constitution. If we talk, we Americans, we talk about it all the time. It's endless. We debate about it all the time. We've amended it 25 some odd times. It seems to be almost spiritual or scriptural to a certain segment of our population, but yet lots of others of us want it to be more dynamic and more open. Why do you think that we Americans, and you're a Briton now living in the United States and been living here for some time, why do you think that phenomenon is so strong here?
I think partly because the Constitution drafted in Philadelphia in 1787 initially stands in for so much in the new United States that is not there yet.
Right.
Americans, or many of them, not of course all of them, could unite to drive out the British. But post driving out the British, how did you unite this people divided into different states with very different opinions, with considerable degrees of local autonomy, scattered over a long distance? Well, that having a codified constitution, a single document, could be a totem that helped unification. Though, of course, not always. Eric Foner, the great American historian, told
right.
me that as late as the mid-19th century, when many Americans talked about their constitution, what they meant was their state constitution.
Yes, yes.
They hadn't yet entirely come to terms with the federal constitution as being the preeminent totem. And of course, there's always the problem, which persists now, that even when it does become totemic, absolutely, many Americans still don't read it or know absolutely what it says. They reverence it, but, and I mean, it's something that other Americanists like Jill Lepore have talked about beautifully and written about. I mean, she pointed out in a fantastic New Yorker piece that the original document of the 1787 draft constitution, which is now a sacred text, but before the Second World War, it was periodically lost.
Yes.
You know, people just sort of didn't have the same attitude. And I think it's often thought that, though not by you, but by outsiders perhaps, that Americans have always reverenced the Constitution. In fact, there's a lot of change over time.
Yes. Oh, there's a lot of change over time. And as you rightly point out, what Professor Foner says, you know, we really have 51 constitutions in this country, and that in terms of our daily lives, it's our state constitution that affects more of our what happens to us than the federal constitution. But Professor, I just have to leave our listeners with one thought here, and then you mentioned Professor Lepore's article in The New Yorker recently, but you very modestly didn't include the part of that article, of that review, and that essay which says that there should be a Nobel Prize for history and that you should get it. What was your reaction when you saw that review?
I found that wonderful review essay early one Monday morning when I was getting ready for work, and I was feeling, as one often does feel, at 6 a.m. on Monday morning, ready for work. It was extraordinary. And, you know, I emailed Jill and said, well, you know, in a fair world, I should be able immediately to dash off and take you for a great lunch, both to discuss her piece and to thank her. But unfortunately, we are in a time of plague. But that brightened
yes.
my morning. Of course
oh, yes.
it did.
Well, in addition, it has the additional benefit of being absolutely true. Those of us who followed your career for years and years would certainly agree. Well, it just remains for me to say to the Buzzkillers that the link for the Joe Lepore article in the New Yorker is on the blog post for this episode. That, of course, the book, your book, the new book, The Gun, the Ship, and the Pen, Warfare, Constitutions, and the Making of the Modern World, is on the Buzzkill bookshelf for our listeners to get it. And it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a tremendous treat for me.
Well, it's been a great privilege, and thank you so much for all your fantastic questions. I'm most grateful.
I'm glad to hear it. So, Buzzkillers, please go to professorbuzzkill.com and check all that stuff out, and we will talk to all of you out there next week.